Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day. Moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And hello there, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org and at iTunes on the tab College Radio. And today is Wednesday, November 23rd, 2011. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are Heather King and Nell Casey. First up is Heather King. Heather graduated from the University of New Hampshire and Suffolk Law School. She did a 10-year stint in Boston and moved to L.A. in 1990. Following a disastrous 4-year run as a Beverly Hills attorney, she quit her job, converted to Catholicism, and began writing. Her commentaries have been aired on NPR's All Things Considered, her essays published, among other places, in the Los Angeles Times Magazine, the Otney Reader, Commonweal, Notre Dame Magazine, Portland Magazine, and The Sun, and her work is anthologized in the Best Spiritual Writing Series 2002, 2005, and 2008. And she was here talking about her last book, Redeemed, and now she's back to talk about her new book, Shirt of Flame, A Year with St. Therese of Lisieux. Let's bring her on. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
Great to have you on again.
Thanks. So wonderful to be here, especially the day before Thanksgiving.
The day before Thanksgiving. It's an interesting day. It's.
I've already said several people. I've had my friends calling me disaster crises already. It's great. Yes, we're in the holidays.
We're in the holidays. Everybody on my street thinks it's a holiday because we have street cleaning on Wednesday, and nobody's moved except me. So. Anyway, talk about Shirt of Flame and how you came to do this book on St. Therese of Lisieux.
I will. First, I was laughing so hard at the your intro, thank you, which I know comes from my website. I just want to say the disastrous run, as the 4-year run as an attorney, was not so much, I didn't make a complete fool of myself, but it was that I was so ill-suited for the law. And
what sort of law did you practice?
I need to spring to my defense. I practice litigation, and my joke is that even agreeing with people makes me nervous. So I'm so not cut out to be. I just want everyone to sit around the table. I'm so not. I avoid confrontation at all costs. So, which brings us to Shirt of Flame, and the title, by the way, comes from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. Refers to the fact that whether we want to or not, we're going to go through some kind of fire, and we can sort of choose whether it's going to be the neurotic fire of sort of hell, of refusing to sort of be born into our truest selves, or the purifying flames of love, the fire that I think everyone who wants to be an authentic spiritual path, fire, it all sounds very good on paper, but to really go through it is, insofar as I have, is pretty excruciating. And, Calicly, the publisher of the book, approached me several years ago and asked me if I'd be willing to write a book about a saint, not a hagiography, which is the kind of typical biography crossed with, wasn't this person uber superhuman, but rather a book about a saint. Because to me, a saint is a person who's just utterly surrendered to reality. This radical acceptance of and surrender to reality, which is very attractive to me. Possibly because I've spent so much of my life running from reality, as 20 years of hardcore alcoholism, for one thing. But anyway, so they asked me if I'd be willing to write a book about sort of walking, quote unquote, with this saint for a year, praying with, reflecting on his or her spirituality. And so I said, sure. And I chose Saint Therese, I knew sort of the outline of her spirituality and her biography, and I think I hadn't heard or studied her deeply. And I came to see during the course of the writing of the book that it was really, I really feel I was drawn to her because I so needed her spirituality, especially at that time in my life. I found it a challenge and a great invitation to write a book about a saint through which is interwoven my own stumbling spiritual journey. And at the time, the year I spent with her, I'm 59 now. I was 57 then. Had been through. I joke about my 30-year midlife crisis, but the whole, I think this is a universal journey that we all go through at a certain time of life. As we do get closer to death, and you do this kind of taking stock of and summing up, and even though I was so clear, oh, I found my three homes, I found sobriety, I found writing, I found the Catholic Church, I'm a convert, still I had this deep, deep sense of, my work is not bearing the fruit that I, just the whole, what am I going to leave behind?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of, and I'd also had a number of specific, I'd had breast cancer, my marriage ended, his 14-year marriage ended, I'd fallen in love with this, the tragicomic falling in, madly in love with the guy who's completely not responding, and then sort of got really badly snagged there and couldn't quite move beyond for, and so, but deep, I mean, just terrible, terrible dark and heartbreak and heartache and this longing. I think this to me is what religion is. It's the holy, this longing, all our procreative urge, our erotic urge, our urge to create, to flourish, to bear fruit, to leave something behind when we do die. And I just felt, oh, this is, I'm going to die and and my life will not have borne fruit. That was my sense. It's not my sense now, but that was what I was going through.
What I like about your writing is that it's so not dogmatic. I mean, you talk about your own experience without proselytizing, and I think that that's a difficult thing to do when you're writing about religion. Who is your ideal reader, and do you have him or her in mind when you're writing?
I'm not sure I have an ideal reader. I have a blog, and I'm very, in a way, maybe the kind of collective voice that comes back, that responds from the blog. I mean, many of which are individual people who I've come to know, if not in the flesh, through. I mean, I think my ideal reader is just someone whose heart also longs and who deeply feels, for whatever reason, the sense, the human condition, this deep sense of existential exile and loneliness that our culture is almost specifically designed to anesthetize. And I think if you're very lucky, it doesn't feel like luck, but you're stripped of enough of your own resources, of your own illusions, so that you get in touch with what is really underneath there, which for me, I mean, you don't have to call it God, but just a longing for the transcendent, a longing, the questioning, what are we here for? Why was I born? I could have not been born. Why do we suffer? Why do we die? Why does my heart respond to this? Why do we feel these stabbing, piercing moments of joy? All of that. And so that's, I know there are, I think that's every human being, actually, in our depths. And so I guess that's who I write to. I write to that sort of human heart, I suppose. And I don't think that's a sappy, sentimental heart to me has a sword thrust through the middle of it. I think this mm-hmm. is the cross, this is reality. You know, can I just tell this little, I'll tell you who, I just spoke at, a friend of mine is a teacher here in LA, Belmont High School, not a great neighborhood, down the street, I live in Silver Lake. I went to speak this, or just to kind of help him with his class, reading essays and so forth, and at the end of it, the kids from the school newspaper said, can we interview you? They interviewed me, this young girl, I think she's a junior, Graciela Espinoza, interviewed me, wrote this piece that captured me better than any, not that I've had a zillion, not that I've been written up all over the world, but she captured me so beautifully. She wants to be a writer. She wrote me a letter and she said, oh, you inspired me so much. I bought your books. I talked to you, talked to my boyfriend about you. And I just thought, I just wept. I mean, it's like, okay, thank you, because that's why I write. Mm-hmm. Like, that's who mm-hmm. I write to. Mm.
Well, you know, it's a fine line, I think, writing about faith or writing about a belief system without sounding self-righteous or as if you're after converts. And one thing you do in this book and in Redeemed is your last is that you bring yourself into it, and it's so definitely from your point of view, and like you said, it's not a treatise on a saint and how wonderful the saint was, so much as sort of your experience through that saint.
Yes, and I think if anything, it's again, this is a huge grace. I mean, I so don't have a platform to stand on if I want to be one of these kind of preachy, pious people who have it all figured out. I mean, it was a total falling down blackout drunk for 20 years. I went to law school more or less in a blackout. Practiced law, was not, I mean, I wasn't horrible at it, but I was not far from a raging success. I've never had a lot of money. I've had my heart broken a million times. I didn't go the husband, children defense, you know, 59 years old, I'm single. But more important, that's the outside stuff, but the conflicted soul and heart, again, of all humanity. I mean, let's talk about it, because that's all we have. That, to me, is reality. And so it's a grace to me to be able to, insofar as I can, abortions. I mean, I have just a terrible track record in the bar. So I get to come to it as a prodigal daughter. And I think we're all prodigal daughters and sons, and just hope someone can identify with that. I do, of course, in one way, I wish everyone would. I mean, I'm a Catholic. I believe Christ is the Alpha and the Omega. I mean, I'm absolutely the center of my life. And yet I realize you don't like chase people down and force. You show them, you just bear witness to what has happened to you, your experience, my experience of faith. Not this is what I believe, but this is what happened to me. Check it out. Mm-hmm. I used to be like this, and now I'm like this. I used to think like that, and now I think this way. Huh. So hopefully that's an attraction, but that's not my goal at all, to convert. My goal is to write well.
Yes, yeah.
To the writer.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine. Heather, this would be a great time to hear you read a little bit from Shirt of Flame. Could you do that?
Sure. I'm going to read a little portion, speaking of which, about prayer. Again, a huge subject. Okay. The goal in prayer isn't to do anything right, to acquire a technique, Therese seemed to be saying. The goal is surrender. She believed it wrong to be afraid of desiring too much or asking God for too much, observed her younger sister, Celine. Continued, quote, we must say to God, I know well that I shall be worthy of the things I hope for, but I hold out my hands to you like a beggar child, and I need you will more than grant my wishes because you are so good. I myself had what I suppose could be called a somewhat deep prayer life, though I'd be at a loss as to how to describe it. Every morning and sometimes at night, I prayed the Divine Office, which is a particular set of psalms and prayers of the Catholic Church. I read and reflected upon that day's liturgy. I engaged for anywhere from 10 minutes to a couple of hours in an activity that I was never quite sure whether to call prayer at all. Sometimes I just sit at sunlight on the wall of my living room or at the top of the tree in front of the apartment building next door. Sometimes I'd simply listen to the birds. The best I can say is that I more or less disappeared. I disappeared, and when I reemerged, I felt closer to reality, more whole, more sure that everything would be all right in the end. Now at the moment, all seemed pain, chaos, and turmoil. Jesus himself never gave any big meditation techniques. He said, this is how you pray, and he gave us the Lord's Prayer. He didn't say you have to keep your back ramrod straight. He didn't say you had to learn to observe your breathing. There was one area of my life that I instinctively and resolutely refrained from trying to make into a project, which is perhaps one reason the guided meditations in which I've recently taken part over the years had left me fairly cold. I much preferred adoration, which is a term of art in the Catholic Church, sitting before the Blessed Sacrament in prayer for silence at, say, Immaculate Heart of Mary, a relatively poor, largely Filipino parish in East Hollywood. Here folks would be snuffling, sneezing, hacking, some kneeling, some sitting, sweaters hung askew off shoulders, rosaries dangled from arthritic fingers. Some eyes were closed, some were open, staring, stricken. People were doubled over, head in hands. People were crying. This seemed to me just the atmosphere in which the Son of Man would have felt at home. I know I did. Here I could imagine myself the prodigal daughter with my head buried in my father's breast. Here I could imagine myself to be Job saying, my God, though thou slayest me, yet will I put my trust in thee. Here I could hear my heart crying, bind up my gaping, hemorrhaging wounds. Tell me what I'm to do next, Father, where I belong. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, a sinner. And just one more paragraph. Sometimes I could also feel my whole being speaking Christ as I went about my routine of work, errands, walking, socializing, mass, occasional travel. Increasingly, I was a little bit better able to handle setbacks, frustration, loneliness. A forgetful friend stood me up for lunch, and within minutes, I'd let the end go. I noticed I didn't always have to have the last word anymore. One day, someone nabbed the parking space I was going to pull into, and without swearing, I simply drove on and found another. This to me is massive. This is my, excuse me, walk towards sainthood. That, seriously, that to me is just huge progress, spiritual progress. I don't think it gets any bigger than that.
Yeah, you're probably right. Especially in Southern California, especially in LA. That is funny. Well, you know, we're drawing down on the end of our time, and I'm curious if, you know, in writing a book like this, where you're writing about somebody, and you're also bringing yourself into it, how does that go? I mean, did you do any sort of outline or plot, or did you kind of follow the flow of from one chapter to the next, bit by bit? How did you do it?
It was kind of a torturous process. I did it month by month because it was a year. So I had, in that sense, I had a very nice structure, January through December. And they had at first, they had told me, my editor left without a word in the middle of the process. So I don't quite know what happened there. But she originally said, or so I thought, we want a memoir. You're a memoir writer. That's why we want you. So I wrote, weaving in tonight this narrative, in a sense, of my year. And I waited and waited and waited. When the notes came, they were basically, there's too much of you in here. So I was, of course, mortified, and then took out a bunch of myself. And then the notes were, there's not enough of you in here. So, but it was a real challenge, because we've got this, I mean, this saint who is just, in the Catholics, she is just huge. She's one of the only three women who have ever been made a doctor of the church. She's a huge saint. And so to write about your own just really, I don't want to say pathetic, but your own spiritual path alongside is really a challenge. And I had to just let go of the whole idea of, I'm so insignificant. And I mean, yes, that's true. But, and so I feel like I was pleased with it. I think I somehow managed to touch on the high points of her spirituality and say how that, and demonstrate how that played out for me in my daily life, because that's what it's all about. It is about our daily lives. It's about, we all want to be kind to the poor, but to find that, yeah, the poor is that neighbor who you hate because he plays his music. The poor is your husband who you're pissed at because he never does the dishes. The poor, everyone in our lives who drive us crazy, and not to mention ourselves. And so to find, oh wow, this is the person I get. This is the person I get to be kind to, not just the homeless person who I see for 5 minutes on the street, maybe, and have a little chat with or something. It's radical. I mean, I think we have a picture of spirituality. We want it to look a certain way, and whether we would admit it or not, we want to be noticed for it, acknowledged, and we just want it to look good from the outside, so that people will be attracted by some way. Oh, that's so cool. Oh, that's so, oh wow, she went to Bali. Oh, she feeds the poor. And I mean, all that is fine, but it's, I think the really radical detachment is to just, be kind to the crotchety, neurotic nun, your sister nun in a cloistered convent. No one's going to see you. Like, that's hardcore love.
It's sort of a good thing to think about as we go out here at the bottom of the hour with hardcore love, and how to especially in this season we're going into, when that's sort of the theme of what we're doing here.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Heather, for spending the time, and great good luck with this new book.
My pleasure. My honor. Thank you so much, Barbara.
You're welcome. That was Heather King, and her book is Sure to Flame, A Year with St. Therese of Lisieux, published by Paraclete, which is a beautiful publisher of books that I'm just finding out about. And if you think spiritual or religious literature is one way, check out Paraclete. It's a whole other way, according to this press, and I love their books. Anyway, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will be here with Nell Casey, who wrote or who edited the journals of Spalding Gray. So stay with us, and I'll be right back with you.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one more bed in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Why do you linger here when there is no hope?
Tempted to think there's no hope for overcoming some of the challenges of modern life? Ask an elf.
Or a hobbit.
Tune in Tuesdays, 4 to 5 p.m. with Milo Lomsdown at your service and...
Tawny Tenuvial, the resident KUCI Middle Earth elf.
For What Would Arwen Do? On KUCI Irvine, 88.9 FM and streaming live on KUCI.org.
I lost my mojo.
You lost it?
I lost it.
Where'd it go?
I don't know, but I found it. I found it on Writers on Writing.
Writers on Writing?
Wednesday mornings at 9. 9 a.m. in the morning.
With Barbara DeMarco Barrett and Marie Stone?
That's them.
Expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are on the web at KUCI.org, and we are also at iTunes on the College Radio tab. So if you know anyone who should be listening to this show, tell them about it and tell them they can listen no matter where in the world they sit. In any case, we are back, and I have Nell Casey on the line. She was on the show a few years back talking about the national bestseller Unholy Ghost, which she edited. She's written for Slate, The New York Times, Salon, Elle, and Glamour, among other publications, and she's back to talk about The Journals of Spalding Gray, published by Knopf. Hi, Nell.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Great to have you back on.
Thank you.
I've been long fascinated with Spalding Gray, and who can forget his monologue Swimming to Cambodia, or even his part in The Killing Fields. And I'm guessing you were fascinated as well to take on this project of editing some, 5,000 pages of journals to,
right,
to a 323-page hardback?
Yeah, no, well, I had always loved his work from the time I discovered it. I mean, I didn't know it until my early 20s when I came to New York, and I actually was assigned by a magazine to interview him, and at the time, the book version of It's a Slippery Slope had just come out. I had heard of him, but I didn't know his work that well, and as soon as I read that, and I was completely taken aback. I think at that point I had not seen Swimming to Cambodia, and then went and saw the movie. I never actually got to see him perform it, which is too bad, but I was, you know, a teenager at the time that he did it.
Mm-hmm.
But so I interviewed him, and I talked to him about this book, which was very, at the time, it was a funny telling experience, because I was supposed to do this Q&A, and I couldn't actually get my question in for his answers, because he was talking in this long, you know, charismatic rush on the phone. So that was my introduction, and then I did go and see everything I could of his, and I read the published versions of his monologues, and I did finally get to see him perform in person. And I also did a piece after he died about a play that his widow, Kathleen Russo, put together with Lucy Sexton, about his life. It was called Leftover Stories to Tell, and it's culled from his monologues and a few of his journal entries. And she had five different readers reading this chronological piece about his life told in his own words. So I wrote about that for the New York Times, and then about a year after I did that, I had interviewed Kathy Russo for it. She came back to me with a proposal to write his biography, and that was not something that I necessarily wanted to do as an authorized biography, but we talked about the journals, and she agreed that I could read them, and I did. And initially I worried that they would be just the rough draft of these monologues that were so revealing, but instead they ended up being these incredible document of his anxiety about being revealing in public life, you know, and sort of the rising tension of creating a character of himself.
That's really interesting, because he seems as though he was so revealing and so at ease doing that.
Right. He was very comfortable on stage, and almost more alive and happy on stage. I mean, he really connected with an audience. He had incredible, almost preternatural calm about being in front of a lot of people. He had incredible, I mean, he was an incredibly talented person, a wonderful storyteller, but had a great, strong sense of his story and memory. You know, he could really do these off-the-cuff performances, though, you know, they were stories he had a sense of beforehand. He only worked from an outline. He didn't really memorize anything ever. But so, you know, he was very alive on stage, and yet he was very riddled with doubt and insecurity about it off stage. I mean, insecurity in the sense that he was anxious about the trade-off between giving over his life in order to have public recognition, and what was that doing to him? What did that mean about his private life if he was always mining it for a story? How did he, you know, what was this kind of compulsive need that he had to confess? And then also an anxiety that he couldn't confess everything, you know, that he was almost too good at the story because he couldn't tell them everything, and that it made him nervous in a way to have a secret from the audience, which he by necessity had to have. I mean, these were 90-minute monologues. He could not tell his whole life, and they would not have been as good had he done that.
How did you decide then what entries stayed and which went, or was it a matter of whittling down what was there?
Well, first I just read everything, and the archive was more than just the journal, so there was this broad archive to read through, which there were incredible numbers of scrap papers and notes on Breast Cancer Coalition pamphlets and hotel stationery and Amtrak napkins. I mean, he wrote on everything, and they were incredible 2- and 3-line thoughts he would have that were almost little bits of poetry, you know. And then there were recordings of everything, of therapy sessions, of audio letters, of himself just sitting around his apartment narrating his life, listening to NPR, you know. So I sort of went through everything that I was given and could get my hands on, and then that themes of his life emerged from that, very clear themes. And they were not different in large part from the themes of his monologues. He talked about the suicide of his mother that haunted him his whole life, and he talks about that in his monologues. He talks about his breakup with Renee Shafransky. That was something he writes about, I mean, he speaks about in the monologues as well as in the diaries. But the themes were the same. The stories were different. I mean, they were just more sprawling. They were more intimate. They were more raw. But with these themes, I was given a kind of roadmap of what needed to stay in order to tell, to give a kind of accurate portrait as I'd read the journals. And then, yeah, I just had to whittle down and whittle down and whittle down and whittle down in order for it to be a sizable book. I mean, not a book that would go on for 10,000 pages.
This would be a great time to hear you read from the intro. Would you do that?
Yeah, sure. So I took a small part of the introduction. It's just an excerpt. Mm-hmm. And here it is. A wooden desk, a glass of water, a notebook, and a microphone. This was the stage setting for a Spalding Gray performance. Gray, with his long patrician face and habitual plaid shirt, sat alone before an audience for the first time in 1979, and, in his distinct New England accent, told stories from his life. It was an ancient notion. The history of confessional storytelling is made up of a group as various as St. Augustine, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Sylvia Plath, and Richard Pryor. Yet Gray's work transformed the theater world, creating an autobiographical genre that has since been so widely replicated, it is hard to imagine the daring it took to come first. Until Gray appeared as himself, the monologue implied a performer inhabiting another character or characters while roaming the stage, such as the theatrical portraits Ruth Draper premiered in 1920, or Lily Tomlin in her 1977 Broadway show, appearing nightly. Gray, on the other hand, absented his body, always sitting calmly at his desk, speaking nakedly about himself, the formative wounds of his childhood, his repressed WASP upbringing, his tangled romantic life, and the intriguingly neurotic way in which he viewed the world. These journals, which begin when Gray was 25 years old and end just before his death at 62, illustrate a teeming underlife that the performer only hinted at on stage. Gray was not only surprisingly capable of keeping parts of his life to himself, he was able to skim these parts, shaving just the top layer of a secret and offering it up as a convincing whole. The well-told partial truth to deflect the private, raw truth Gray himself observed about his monologues in his journal. This is not to say that Gray wasn't compelled to publicly confess. He was. This need, as well as the release and redemption he felt in confiding to an adoring audience, was possibly the greatest driving force of his life. But as his career evolved, as he grew older, as his interests and desires and relationships became ever more complex, his aim to continually tell his story became more difficult. Gray could not reveal everything, not only because he knew the best stories were lively distillations, but also out of the fear that too bold a truth might alienate his followers. He craved the love of his audience, and his audience wanted only a representative of Spalding Gray, a spokesperson for truth. This dynamic made Gray increasingly introspective, ever aware of his public even as he was simply going through the day. The audience became the witness without whom he felt as if he didn't exist. The description of a memory makes a new reality, he wrote in an undated journal entry. Am I more real in front of an audience? In 1991, he wrote simply, there is nothing private left. As long as he considered everyone and everything as material for a story, there was little room for real or unselfconscious life. These journals make up the rough draft of Gray's adult life, the version he sought and often felt he lost once it was crafted and brought to light in his monologues. Here is the raw material, the wrenching emotional breakdown he suffered in 1976, following a trip to India, his time in Thailand making the killing fields, his jittery first marriage, that Gray later reproduced with swift literary hindsight in his performances. These pages show how the monologist intuitively shaped his narrative, as well as the character of Spalding Gray, with a penetrating eye and a soothing bit of self-deprecation for his audience. In the journals, he frequently comes across in a more extreme way, his anguish and needs not tempered by his perceptive charm. Publishing these journals poses a question that echoes Gray's own moral quandary. What is worth revealing? It seems throughout his career that Gray wanted both to be known and not, to seek the truth and to create it. And yet this book is an endeavor made in the spirit of his mission. More than once in these journals, Gray quotes a line from the book of Job, spoken by the messengers delivering the news that Job's children and servants and animals have died. I alone have escaped to tell you. We have lost Gray, but there is still more for him to tell us.
Thank you so much. That was Nell Casey reading from The Introduction to the Journals of Spalding Gray, just published by Knopf. Gosh, so much to talk about here. Your last book was Unholy Ghost, well, the last book you were on here with, Writers on Depression.
Right.
And he dealt with depression. And my sense is that this is one of your themes.
Yes, I have emerged as my own theme, it's true. But I hadn't sort of made that connection explicitly when I got the journals and became so interested in them. I was really interested in this dilemma of public revelation and private angst and anxiety. But then it obviously was a good fit for me, too, given my interest in depression. And he did suffer from depression and interestingly sort of created his own way out of it, which were these monologues. I mean, pretty reliably, he was in a kind of disorganized emotional state, and then he would start working on a monologue, and it would start to give him some sense of order and some sense of boundary and some sense of calm in a way that he couldn't get in life, you know. So that was really interesting to me, that his art provided a kind of balm to his emotional state. And unfortunately, that was taken from him at the end of his life. He was in a car accident in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And after that accident, he suffered many different physical injuries, including brain trauma, and suffered from incredible depression. And he just could not perform in the way he once had. So I'm sort of taking this question in a completely other way.
Except no, that's good.
It's very interesting to sort of see both the rhythm of his depressions as they existed throughout his life, to see that he kind of consistently was able to pull himself out of them by the ritual of creating a monologue and performing it, and then when you see him sort of lose this routine and ritual, he really, that was part of the big problem for him at the end. I mean, part of what really ultimately led to his suicide.
Interesting. I was surprised to see that he has quite a website going on still, and that there are still events and such a fan base that keeps it going.
Yeah, his fan base is really interesting because he has a very broad fan base and not of one kind of, you know, there's no stereotypical fan of Spalding Gray, and partly that was because he was a big performer downtown in New York, but he also went and performed at Lincoln Center, and then he just had a very different audience after that, and then he traveled a lot with his shows, so he, you know, created a much larger fan base that way, and then his movie sort of broadened his the awareness of him, too. But yeah, I think that the website is maintained by just a very loyal fan, and there are a lot of events around these various projects that have come out after his death. So there was the Steven Soderbergh documentary called And Everything Is Going Fine, and that continues to screen. And I think Kathy Russo occasionally will speak at screenings. And then there was her play, Leftover Stories to Tell, which traveled and, you know, went to many theaters around America. And now with the book, there's a third, you know, round of events. So he's had a kind of busy afterlife.
Yeah, he sure has. My goodness. How does working on a project of this magnitude take over your life? And I mean, is this, were you able to get any writing done? Because I know you publish articles and essays and
Not really. I mean, I wrote a lot for the book. As it turned out, the book just from the start, it was clear to me and to the editor I worked with that there should be a narrative of mine, kind of giving a coherent bridge between, you know, each decade, and so I wrote quite a bit for the book. So that writing I was doing, but I didn't write otherwise, really. I mean, there were certain breaks where the book was in with the editor, and I was waiting to hear, and I could do a little more then. But it was fairly encompassing, and it took a lot longer than I imagined it would at first. I mean, I'm always not very good at estimating how long these things will take me, but it took 3 years all told, with, you know, here and there were breaks of time. But it was it was just a massive project. It was both a massive editing project and a big undertaking in terms of the writing, too. And I had to really know his public performances in order to discern his private life in the journals and to understand when he wasn't actually just trying something out for monologues, or when he was writing a story that he later changed and altered for his monologues, or if he was actually writing something that was truly kept private and never mined for his monologues. There were a lot of levels on which I had to be working, editing and writing and understanding his life.
When you're in any project, do you ever reach points where you're just really not sure where to go with your writing, and maybe there's a place where you could go this way or that way, so you go no way because you don't know what to do next? And if so, how do you get through that? What sort of ways have you found to get through those points of either blockage or confusion
I never felt I don't know that I can write anything here. I mostly just worry that what I've written is bad. So I guess I'm not someone who deals, although of course I'm going to say this and it'll probably come down on me like a punishment for saying it, but I haven't been blocked so much as I've just written and then thought, oh, that's horrible.
What do you do when you film?
Well, it takes a while, and I think this is always true, to admit that it's not working for me. And then I will just scrap whole huge sections and start again. And then starting again is usually a much easier process because I've worked out whatever confusion, or I've cleared the hurdle by doing a bad first draft and then getting rid of it. But in this case, the writing had such a clear... I had such clear guideposts because I had to get the reader from one part of his life to the next, and I didn't want to interrupt his journal entries very much. So I was basically giving these mini biographies at the beginning of a decade just to give the reader context and to send them in with a sense of being oriented. And so it was a more pleasurable writing project in that sense because I wasn't, you know, just creating something from... I really had a sense of what I needed to do. And as I say, the editor that I had on this, Robin Desser at Knopf, was incredible and was so supportive that when I felt I couldn't figure out what to do and I turned in something to her, I didn't feel scared to turn in something that wasn't working. I mean, in fact, she was doing exactly what an editor should do, which is reading things and realizing where it wasn't working and trying to figure it out with me if it wasn't, you know, or encouraging me where it was working. So it was a different kind of writing project, and I've never actually written a full book on my own. The other books I've done, I edited, or I edited and wrote an essay for it. You know, I've always sort of joined with another person or many other people in my book. So, you know, maybe the next project I'll do on my own, and I'll come back on your show and talk about writer's block.
No. I mean, it's interesting because you have these book projects, and then you write articles, you write essays, and you do other sorts of writing, which,
yeah.
I wonder if that's a function of just, for me, it's often a function of, I get bored easy, so I need a lot of different things going on, so that if this one isn't working, this one might be.
Mine is more a function of just financial stuff, but also I do enjoy, you know, writing shorter after the Spalding, after I finished the manuscript for the Spalding book. I did go out and do a lot of different freelance pieces, and they were so satisfying because you could get through them, and it was, after a three-year project, it was so satisfying to write something and be done with it in a few weeks, you know, or be done with it in a month or shorter, you know. So it was nice to, I like that rhythm of not always just plunging into the long projects, but having a little bit of small triumphs in between. And also those are the shorter pieces are the things that get me out in the world to sort of think about what a longer book might be, you know. So, I do enjoy that, and I enjoy, you know, so those are the reasons that I go out there and freelance in between or during. But I would prefer, I mean, in a perfect life, I would be doing long projects without a lot of interruptions. You know, I would prefer not to have the pressures to go out and do smaller things if I'm, you know, needing to make some money. But I basically was able to stick with this book in the periods that I needed to and without distraction.
Excellent. Wow. We're at the end of our time here, and I wonder if you have either any advice for our listeners or advice that you were given along the way that has stuck with you and has proved helpful.
That is a very good question. Wish I had a perfect answer ready. I will say, as I've gone on, I used to be much more, and I sort of answered this in a previous answer, but I'll just try and shine it up and give you a polished gem. But I just think allowing yourself to go forward and have a draft that's not in your mind fully done or completely crafted in the way you want, and then taking it, you know, passing it on, I mean, just letting it go, is better to me than the kind of constant tinkering I used to do. Because it really, truly ended up becoming a waste of time. It was a more controlling impulse than a creative impulse. And so for me, that has become a good lesson and I have to say it really helped to have an editor that I felt comfortable doing this with, that I could let something go and it wasn't in perfect form, and especially with a book, it's not going to be in perfect form for such a long time, that letting it go in pieces was okay, you know. I mean, it was a good way to keep going forward.
Well, I'm so glad this book is in my hands and that I've been reading it and just really enjoying it. I enjoy your writing, and I've always liked Spalding Gray, and thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
That was Nell Casey. Her book is The Journals of Spalding Gray, published by Knopf, a beautiful cover, and just so much good stuff here that please take a look, especially if you had any interest in Spalding Gray ever. It's really worth your time. We're at the end of our time, and thank you for listening. Thank you for being here the day before Thanksgiving 2011. And there's some funny stuff on Thanksgiving on Maud Newton's site, what Mark Twain thought of Thanksgiving, you know, how Thanksgiving originated, which is not a warm and fuzzy. And unfortunately, we don't have time for me to go into it now, so maybe check out Maud Newton's blog and read down where Mark Twain talks about Thanksgiving. Until next time, you have been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine, KUCI. Have a great weekend, and see you next week.